Dublin. Welcome to The Quarantine Tapes, a daily podcast from Onassis, LA and Dublin. Hosted by Paul Holdengraber, this series chronicles shifting paradigms in the era of social distancing.
Hello, could I please speak with Sven Burkert?
Yes, you have made contact. He's here.
How wonderful, Sven. It is such a pleasure to speak to you. This is Paul Holdengraber calling you from the Quarantine Tapes, co-presented by Dublab and Onassis LA. I have been waiting to speak to you, it feels like, for years. You've been part of my intellectual landscape for so very long that I am really delighted to have you be a part of this chronicle of our delirious times. Tell me, how have you been spending these past 11 months? Or perhaps, before I even ask you this question, I'm going to read something to you and have you respond to it, and I have a feeling that it might speak to you and maybe might even speak to your present circumstances. It is an essay by Walter Benjamin called Unpacking My Library, a talk about book collecting. He begins in this way. He says, "I am unpacking my library. Yes, I am. The books are not yet on the shelves, not yet touched by the mild boredom of order. I cannot march up and down their ranks to pass them in review before a friendly audience. You need not fear any of that. Instead, I must ask you to join me in the disorder of crates that have been wrenched open and air saturated with the dust of wood, the floor covered with torn paper, to join me among piles of volumes that are seeing daylight again after 2 years of darkness, so that you may be ready to share with me a bit of the mood. It is certainly not an elegiac mood, but rather one of anticipation which these books arouse in a genuine collector. For such a man is speaking to you, and on closer scrutiny, he proves to be speaking only about himself."
Yes, that is the bookman's mantra, or the book person's mantra. It's amazing how quickly, in the space of a few phrases, one enters that world, steps away from wherever one is for a short time. But that has been characteristic of my recent experience, as I suggested at some point to you. Leaving one house after 30 plus years of living there, it's just books everywhere. And well ahead of the time of the moving, I knew I had to get down to business, which meant, I guess, I underestimated what it would take, because I thought, well, I'll get those boxes and put the books in. But there's no such thing, really, because each book has to be picked up by itself, really, and you can't pick up a book that you've somewhere bought or read or intend to read without having, at least a short sort of flicker of meditation on that particular book. And when you're doing that with hundreds and hundreds of books, it's exhilarating and it's exhausting. And that's sort of builds up to part of the great nostalgia of leaving a place, because you're taking out all the bricks, all the pieces that were there as components. And I suppose the reward on the other end is when you arrive at a place that has just vast gaping shelves and it's all there for you, yes, I am unpacking my library. A huge pleasure, and much, much self-recognition, which at some point I could go into, but yeah.
Don't delay or digress further. Tell me what you mean by that.
Well, I mean, once you have shelves and books, if you're a certain type of person, you need a system. You need a way to arrange them, not too anal, but so you can still grapple with your holdings. And then you have to kind of determine which ones go closest to the desk, because those are the ones that not only are ready to reach to hand, but also send their wonderful accumulated dense little auras toward you while you're sitting in their vicinity. And then there's the whole question of, well, novels, that used to be the main stuff of my life, reading novels, and that part has sort of cooled off. So I have a great many novels that I love, but I'm not likely to, in the short term, go back necessarily. So those get put a little farther away. So by the time you finish, you've kind of layered sort of the sediments of your own interiority, I suppose, just based on, you know, shale here and some granite here and whatever.
And one thing that you're speaking about, as you're speaking about leaving novels, as it were, for another life, is you're talking about the relationship of you as a reader and the relationship of you as a reader who is aging, and the relationship of aging and reading, and the relationship of aging and taste. I'm wondering how all of that resonates with you.
Oh, no, you're absolutely right. And that might be the next sort of continuing aspect of this. Novels were the stuff of my life well into my 40s, in large part because I spent, you know, 20, 30 years as a reviewer, and my bailiwick was basically literary fiction. And so I just lived in that world and picked up everything and collected it and piled it up. I've left that world. I left it a while back in order to grow up into the essay form a little more. Suddenly the review seemed very predictable, kind of a template notion, and the essay beckoned with all of its exploratory possibilities. And that just led me away from the novel in that sense of, you know, at a certain point in your life, or my life, it was the greatest pleasure to be lost in someone else's construction. And I think it had a lot to do with the years of original self-making, because each plot line and each character identification is also working on yourself. And at some point, you're tired of working on yourself. So yeah, then the essay and the memoir, that whole phase took over, and those energies went in a slightly different direction.
To stay one more moment with you as a subject unpacking his library and coming back to Benjamin's extraordinary essay, he quotes Anatole France, a wonderful, wonderful line where he says, "Suffice it to quote the answer which Anatole France gave to a Philistine who admired his library, and then finished with the standard question, 'And you have read all these books, Monsieur France?' 'Not one tenth of them. I don't suppose you use your Sèvres china every day.'" I've always loved that response, and I've always been, you know, when people come and see the library I have, they always ask me if I've read every book, and my standard answer to that is twice.
Right, which is the right answer. I think the interesting thing, I mean, I think in Benjamin's world, it was not just the fact that a book is yet unread, but also he was dealing with a kind of collector's mentality, in the sense of fine books, and one doesn't necessarily read all of one's fine as in collectible books. I mean, I think that's partly what he might be saying. For me, and I too have, you know, a great, great many unread books, but that's the interesting part of going from room to room and gradually constructing a sort of path of ambitions for myself. You know, I could even be very specific, because all these books, now that they're in a new position, have a new sort of valence to them. So, you know, my eye falls on V.S. Naipaul's The Enigma of Arrival, which I read years ago. And the minute I saw it, I realized I was too young to read that book. So I took it down. And then later the eye finds a spot on the shelf where there's some various Kierkegaard books. And I think, boy, it's been way too long. I should... You know, so you start laying out your potential menu, and as you're doing that, you're clarifying where you think your mind and your spirit are apt to be heading. So, yeah.
Some 15 years ago, you wrote a book which was tremendously important to me, deeply, I think deeply nostalgic. And that nostalgia, I wonder how it plays out now. It's called The Gutenberg Elegies, The Fate of Reading in an Electronic Age. I think you published it in 2006. And of course, the fate of reading in an electronic age has evolved so deeply, Sven, in the last 15 years since you wrote that book, which at that time was already nostalgic. And I'm wondering how you would both evaluate that the passage of time since you wrote the book and what has emerged since then, and then respond to this one very short quotation by the film director Alejandro Iñárritu, who says, "Beware of the dictatorship of the algorithm."
Ah, okay. Well, as I'm listening, I'm already trying to imagine how I'm going to fashion the knot of the various things that I would ideally bring together to answer your question. Since we didn't go to the COVID, how's your year been question, I would come back to that, not to talk about COVID, but to identify first off that for me, when it clearly arrived and took root in this, on our shores, to me, it was very much a honor about December 10th, the world changed, because I felt this was not just another thing, this was the same. And by that, I mean that it marked a really almost impassable before and after barrier, almost like a wall somebody would want to put up between two nations. And then we got acclimated, and here we are, we're still weaning out of our, you know, various COVID despairs. But I actually thought then, and I still think now, that this is not a go back. This is, it's something new. And however much people pretend that it's a matter of resumption, I still don't think it is, because I think it has left something in the core for all of us. And if nothing else, it's many things, but I think it is a underscoring and verification of the extreme fragility of the world that I think we might have grown up feeling was a good deal more solid. I feel like COVID did what climate change hasn't yet managed to do. It was taken in immediately because it had the immediate threat of sickness and death in it. And it had its skeptics and all that. But so the world is different. And I think, speaking of algorithms, one thing that has happened here is that this year has considerably upped our reliance on our technologies, virtual and digital. And in the process, it has brought them forward much more quickly than they might have naturally. I mean, natural momentum was, yes, there's going to be a, you know, enormous takeover that's already well underway. But this, I feel, sort of had a finalizing. It showed all the things that we could do without seeing each other and so on. And that, to me, goes back to my central notion that we are leaving behind one paradigm, the sort of old world, analog, somewhat humanistically tinged, individualistic assumptions about life. And we are moving, you know, by various degrees into a kind of a socialized stream, a sort of, there's nothing you can do now where you don't have to enter into a system ruled by those very algorithms, and you can't get anything wrong. You are being, you know, coached to be a certain kind of person if you want to successfully operate in this world, which I so resist, and it brings me so much grief. But so, as you know, I spent the last year writing a book about a book, which was Nabokov's Speak Memory, which was in no sense a book of criticism, and in no sense of any kind of biography of Nabokov. It was a chronicle of my long-term living with a book, and what are the implications of carrying an important book through decades of your life, and how it impinges on and draws forth certain things in your own experience. So all of that was there. And just to round it off, because you had asked me if I had anything I wanted to read, I had a not terribly long passage, which kind of, I hope, ties some of these things together. So it's from the very end of the book, Speak Memory, not his book, my book. I say, my views, formed in the pre-digital era, were based on certain assumptions, givens. I studied the humanities for years, and I embraced Emerson's imperative to create a true and unique self, as well as the idea that wisdom and meaning can be struggled for and achieved. The arts were clearly vital to this. Reading Orwell and Huxley in college, I shuddered at their visions of a robotic citizenry, of complete social control by systems, of helpless capitulation to enforced norms. When I was in school, I saw these as exaggeratedly paranoid fantasies, not as actual threats. Now I understand how deeply they have infiltrated my thinking. And then the second paragraph, I consider Speak Memory to be a private existential guide leading the way in this massive reconfiguration of values, an antidote to many of my fears. Just opening the book starts to refresh my convictions. Nabokov's prose gives me a world of inward possibility, a belief that there are meanings to be discovered and patterns to be remarked. It underscores and enacts the importance of attention, keyword, which is not just a mode of approaching things, but is also how we recognize the variety and intricacy of all things. Attention shows us the finely drawn markings on the wings of a moth, and the memoir is a place hospitable to private contemplation and all that is unique to itself. So it's a plea for individuality in a world where all the trajectories and momentums, you know, are pushing so hard against the realization of individuality, as, you know, I think many of us grew up conceiving as, you know, that's what we were after.
But of course, you have written one of the most extraordinary essays on attention, particularly making us very attentive to what Simone Weil wrote when she wrote that attention is a form of prayer, not the exact quotation, but nearly. And I would like to, in a way, take it slightly in a different direction, Sven. I would love to talk to you for an hour of attention in an age of distraction, or as T.S. Eliot has it, we're distracted from distraction by distraction. I'd like to take it in another direction, which is, Proust wrote a beautiful book, which I'm sure you know very well, called On Reading. And in it, he says something which is, I think, really important and can be overlooked in our love for books, in our love for reading, in our nostalgic celebration of that activity. He says, beware of substituting reading for life. And here's what he says. For as long as reading is for us an instigator whose magic keys have opened the door to those dwelling places deep within us that we would not have known how to enter, its role in our lives is salutary. It becomes dangerous, on the other hand, when instead of awakening us to the personal life of the mind, reading tends to take its place, when the truth no longer appears to us as an ideal which we can realize only by the intimate progress of our own thought and the efforts of our own heart, but as something material deposited between the leaves of books like a honey fully prepared by others and which we need only take the trouble to reach down from the shelves of libraries and then sample passively in a perfect repose of mind and body.
How Proustian that is. I think that hits on, I completely agree with that, the formulation that you do not replace life with reading. And I would say, in my experience, it's always the sort of, it's not a coexistence exactly or an adjacency, but there's a little bit of creative friction that goes on between the reading and the living. And that was part of what this Nabokov book is also about. It's, you know, it's so wrong to think that while you're reading a book, so long as you're physically, you know, moving your eyes across its lines of print, I'm so interested in the way that a book that actually reaches, that has some potency for oneself, it's just in there, it's in there in the day. Some books, you know, if they don't impinge on my thought in some way every day, they do often enough. And this happens, you know, over years and then decades. And you realize at a certain point that you're carrying the thing. It has entered you. It has affected you. And that, in a way, is the afterlife of reading. But in a way, it's the real life of reading. Reading was just getting you ready to have this ongoing experience, provided that the book has some, you know, put some pressure on your life, I guess.
You wrote this beautiful book with a marvelous title. I must congratulate you on this title, called Changing the Subject, with again this a subtitle which is similar in some way or resonant in some way with the Gutenberg elegies, Art and Attention in the Internet Age, and connected to the Iñárritu quotation we've been pondering. You have a wonderful essay on serendipity, and I'm wondering why you have a gripe with serendipity.
Oh, I don't know that I do. In fact, that essay long preceded what became a year-long collaboration with a very good friend, a writer, Chris Benchley, who lives down the road here. We did 100 exchanges around the theme of serendipity because it seemed rich in the possibility of putting out signals in all directions and therefore allowing us to perpetuate this conversation. I actually am not, whatever I said in that essay, and God knows I can't remember it now, but serendipity is, it's a central motif, I think, in my life. And it connects also with picture taking. The whole question of inadvertency interests me. Also, you know, you sent that wonderful other Simone Weil quote about attention is not leaning in. Do you have the words directed?
Yes, it's something of that nature. It's passive in some way.
Yes, that I think it's a small distinction you would think, but it's an enormous distinction. It's really a kind of a metaphysics. And I find, again, possibly a product just of getting older and possibly a result of some accumulation of wisdom. But yes, to know when to let something alone. That's what she means by absolute attention. It's not attention that is instrumental or that wants something from whatever it is.
Right, right. And when I mentioned serendipity and your gripe, I meant the way in which serendipity, perhaps in our time, can become, as it were, commodified.
Yes.
And you know, in that essay, which I encourage everybody to read in the beautiful book of yours, which also has a marvelous essay on the photographer Kertész and his book on reading, you go through the whole origin, perhaps inspired somewhat by Carlo Ginzburg's beautiful essay on clues and the historian as a detective, where he also speaks about the origin of the word serendipity. In closing, very sadly, might I say to you, Sven, we didn't really address the pandemic, but it's in the background in some way, and it certainly was brought up by you in an answer to one of my questions. There's a line in A la recherche du temps perdu, in Remembrance of Things Past, where Proust writes, even when one is no longer attached to things, it's still something to have been attached to them, because it was always for reasons which other people didn't grasp. Well, now that I'm a little too weary to live with other people, these old feelings, so personal and individual, that I had in the past, seem to me, it's a mania of all collectors, very precious. I open my heart to myself like a sort of vitrine and examine one by one all those love affairs of which the world can know nothing. And of this collection, to which I'm now much more attached than any others, I say to myself, rather as Mazarin said of his books, but in fact without the least distress, that it will be very tiresome to have to leave it all. How does that resonate with
you? Yeah, that's another a powerful set of sentences. It does, yeah, it points to the importance not only of having, but of having had, and the residue that it leaves, which finally, the residue of having had is your experience cumulatively, you know, and that idea of the separation from something that either was once important or that hasn't been reached, but which is kind of a liminal, fraught area between. I mean, I do think huge parts of life happen right in that area. So.
Of letting go.
Letting go.
Then I'm sorry to let you go, but it's been a real pleasure to talk to you. As I said, you've been so much part of my life, and I've resisted you in the sense that I resist the notion that I want to become too nostalgic for old forms of communication and old forms of interiority. But as much as I resist you, I haven't quite been able to. So I'm really grateful that you took the time, and I hope the move is a good move, and that in walking up and down the shelves of your library, you discover a whole new set of thoughts. And as Benjamin so beautifully says, the discovery of an old book is also its rebirth. So let it be that for you.
Absolutely. And the sentiment is mutual and possibly slightly amplified from my direction. But this was, again, it's like a book. There's the talk itself, but then there's the everything that leads up when you know you're going to have a talk with a person whose sensibility you have some apprehension of. And then there's the aftermath of the talk. So, so worthy on all fronts, and I'm delighted to have been on.
Thank you so much. And I hope that when this moment too shall pass, we will actually meet in person.
We once did, oddly enough. Years ago, it was the Miami Book Fair. You were there to interview Adam Phillips. But we were sharing a car. You were in the back seat with Ben Lerner, and I was in the front seat trying to introduce myself to you. But it was a chaotic...
Extraordinary. Well, in which case, partie remise, let's hope it happens again in a less chaotic way.
Yes.
All the very best to you.
Well, thank you, Paul.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
To support this show and Dublab's progressive programming, go to dublab.com/support.